This podcast is brought to you by College Football's Title IX Kangaroo Courts. Ending careers without any proof, ignoring proof of innocence, and oftentimes covering up or ignoring actual abuse to women.
Menace to society.
It is July 1st, 2019. Well, for our Patreon subscribers, at least. If the rest of the listeners, it is July 2nd, 2019. Just want to thank you for tuning in. Quick update. We surpassed 170,000 downloads and listeners. I'm really excited. This week, I'm hoping we hit 200K. It's going to be really good. I really want to keep this growth trending upwards. The Patreon subscriptions have been rolling in, and we're building something concrete with that platform. I hope everyone was able to catch our offshoot show this weekend we did. We're doing it weekly. It's called Beyond the Show, a way to get all your questions answered and still provide two solid episodes of content. So make sure you check that out and submit questions. And if you haven't yet, it is extremely low cost and it will give you access to exclusive content. And minimally, if nothing else, it'll give you access to these shows at least a day early. And it also, in the future here, in the next couple weeks and moving forward, it'll give you access to additional shows, additional segments, additional information, and really just carte blanche access. You won't be disappointed. So if you could support us and are interested in checking it out, go to patreon.com/menacetosocietypodcast. And that's patreon.com. And then the number 2 in Menace to Society Podcast. And sign up now. Get your priority subscription with all of our exclusive content and prioritize questions for our Beyond the Show episodes. We're still working through the sponsorships and advertising partnerships, and that platform is still open and available, hoping to launch that by the end of this month. So if you are interested or have an idea of someone who might be, please reach out to us via our website, menacetosocietypodcast.com, or email us. And I screwed this up last week. The email is sponsorship@menacetosocietypodcast.com. All right, just want to quickly wrap up last week's episode. Had some great feedback. Actually had one of the main topics was about Torrence Gibson, a great high school talent that I recruited that had a tragic story. And he actually reached out and we reconnected and we talked. And he's doing well. He's still training, got some NFL tryouts. But I was reminded about a story. I didn't tell you guys this before the show. I forgot. Wait till you hear this story. And here's how it ties in. So Torrence, I talked about his visit to Friday Night Lights up in Ohio, right? And he, when he came up, some random guy brought him. And we had planned on Torrence coming, but then he backed out because there was a coach in the area, right, at Miramar High School. His name was Matthew Strout. And I had been recruiting the area for a while. I met him a bunch of times, and he was this huge, like Billy Buckeye, like biggest Buckeye fan ever. Like told me stories like his both of his sons' middle names, one was Hayes and one was Urban, right? And he told me all these stories about playing at Ohio State. He was a walk-on back in the late 90s. He knew Luke Fickell and Mike Vrabel really well. And I remember coming back and telling Luke about this guy, and I'm showing him a picture of him. And this is me and him in a hallway. He's like, Zach, I don't know who that is. I'll talk to him, put him on the phone. I'll fake it. But I don't remember that guy. So whatever, we're going on. And this guy was super Buckeye fan. Like if you took, what's that douchebag's name?
Buckeye guy.
If you took Buckeye guy and made him less douchey and more high school coach looking, that was this guy, right? And so he even wore a sweater vest to be like Tressel on game days at Miramar High School, right? This guy was like your dream as a recruiter. Like, holy shit, this guy's going to help me so much. Fast forward to the end of that year, come to find out he gets busted by the school for falsifying his entire resume, never went to Ohio State. I don't know if he ever stepped foot on campus. Wow. And he was, called out or exposed for being completely fraudulent about it.
And this is the guy that brought Torrence?
Well, he was supposed to bring Torrence and ended up backing out. His wife didn't want him to go or something like that. And so I don't know if he set up this random another street guy, agent yeah. to bring him or whatever. But yeah. That was just a funny story that someone brought up to me after the fact that I completely forgot about.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was crazy. But Torrence is, I think I might try to get Torrence on the show too, because he has obviously a very insider insight into false accusations and how they can affect your career as an athlete. And I think it'll be really beneficial. It'll be a sad but entertaining story, if you want to call it that. But also, it'll kind of hopefully help provide a an insight into what's possible, the power that you give someone when you enter that type of relationship, especially if you have a target on your back like Torrence did, like any of these college athletes do. So I definitely want to talk about that. Before we get started with the two main segments we have today, I want to talk about what is going on in college football right now. Like today, July 1st, what is going on?
Not much, right?
So here's what happens. And Mickey Marotti, the strength coach at Ohio State, used to make fun of the full-time coaches all the time. And he used to talk so much trash to the coaches and to the players about the coaches. Because the coaches, about end of June, they just get out of town. I mean, they got 3.5 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks, depending on the program, and they are gone. Gone. I mean, on vacation, Bora Bora, Bali, whatever, wherever they go, some resort, and they are out of town. And so that leaves a team of players with a strength staff, right? And those strength coaches, that's why people undervalue strength coaches in college football. Those strength coaches are about to take a month, the most critical month of preparation prior to season, and get that team ready. That's why there's all these notorieties for coordinators and position coaches and great recruiters. There is no notoriety nationally for the great strength coaches, and there should be.
Well, I think Coach Mick got some notoriety recently because he got that big extension in the contract.
So yeah.
They're starting to pay him better, at least.
But can you find me someone that lives in SEC country? Maybe that's a bad example. Let's say, can you find me someone that lives in Clemson land that knows who Mickey Marotti is?
Probably not.
Can you name the strength coach at Clemson right now?
No, definitely not.
No. No. And so the moral of the story is why? That guy is impacting the success of college football as much or more than any coordinator, right? And so that I'm just telling you, if you really want to dive into programs and who does well, look at strength coaches because they're about to take a month by themselves and transform the Ohio State Buckeyes or the Alabama Crimson Tide into who you see this fall. And that's not to take away from two-a-days or spring ball or anything like that. But as far as physical development, this is where they are. And right now, so that a lot of times what strength coaches do is they take the winter program, and that's all about getting bigger, stronger, developing toughness. I mean, that is like your power lifting, sweat and chains grind to get guys just to explode physically. And then you go through spring ball, right? And you gotta get them back to football skill. And then the summer is all about getting them in football shape. They're not trying to get faster for a 40. They're not trying to get stronger for a bench press. They're trying to get functional football skill and development. And so that's what they do. I know Coach Mick is a great example, and any of big time programs do this. They take these summer conditionings and summer agilities, and it's all football specific. It's all football drills. It's all football oriented exercise, and it's all to get them ready for the season. And so it's a critical time. Also, right now, here's what else is going on. To pull the curtain back, there's a number of interns at every program on an iPad logged into a coach's iCloud messaging recruits saying, "How's your summer going? Hope it's going well." So just a PSA to recruits, what I always used to tell recruits, because I always did it on my own. I had an intern help me, but I was always right there. We were always doing it together or in communication about it. I would challenge a recruit to do this. When a coach sends you a text in the middle of July, text him back and say, "Hey, can you call me right now?" 90% of the time, that phone will be silent. Yeah. But what doing that does, and I used to tell recruits that all the time, call that coach right now. Right, he just texted you, call him right now. Call him, see if he answers. Because you're getting blinders put on. So it's just that's what's going on right now in your favorite college football program. All right, so I want to get back to, we haven't done it in the last couple episodes, I want to get back to our top 10 segment.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so this week's top 10 segment is going to be the top 10 players in my career that overachieved. And this is really a testament to development, a testament to identification, a testament to having conviction about a kid as an assistant coach or a recruiter. But it's also going to be about 14 stories to every kid that's getting recruited, either getting overlooked or getting underranked or undervalued by these services. Because none are perfect and none can truly predict what happens. And at a later date, we'll get into the top 10 overhyped or didn't live up to the hype players. Because there's, I mean, countless numbers of those as well. So I'm going to start with four honorable mentions in my career. First one is still a current player at The Ohio State University. The 683rd best player in America was Malik Harrison, starting linebacker last year and will be this year at Ohio State. Just how he came about, and there's a guy on this list that I haven't mentioned as a great recruiter that is phenomenal at this, at identifying a potential great player is undervalued or underranked, and that's Luke Fickell. So this is a local Columbus kid. Luke Fickell brought him to me because the kid was a basketball player. I mean, tall, freaky, and he said, I don't think this kid's a receiver, but I don't know what else to call him. And so he said, can you watch his film? Can you go watch him? And his film was very average player. So my son and I, Cam and I, went to watch him play basketball. And so we went there. Funny story, Chris Worley, one of our linebackers, was also there with a girl. They were watching someone. I don't remember. But Chris Worley and my son had this little rivalry about Xbox and who would beat who and Madden. So they were talking during the game. But anyways, side story. So we go to watch him play basketball, and I just watched this absolute freak of nature on the basketball court, getting every rebound, dunking, everything. Looked like a skill player, but he was a big kid. You could tell he was going to be big. And so I came in, and I told Luke, I said, that kid's a no-brainer Ohio State player. I don't know what he is, but there's another guy on the list like that. And so Luke was already on board with taking him as a linebacker, but I think he wanted a second voice to back him. And so I backed him, and now the kid is, I mean, he's going to be an NFL football player. So he was an honorable mention player that is overachieving. The next player I have on this list is an offensive lineman that Florida fans might know, SEC fans might know, was a kid named John Jalapio. He was the 998th player nationally. Think about that. Almost the 1,000th best player in the country. And how he ended up at Florida is... it really shouldn't happen, right? The 1,000th best player shouldn't go to Florida. But Steve Addazio he had a very, very unique way to recruit kids that he just fell in love with. He saw potential and fell in love with. So he recruited him. And the kid ended up having a great career at Florida. Was, a late pick, like sixth-round pick. And he's still playing in the NFL for the New York Football Giants, which has been, I don't know, when was he drafted?
2014, I believe.
14, so that's what, 5 years? So yep. 5 years in for a lineman. That's already a good career, and he's still playing. The next player was a kid that I knew about. I didn't personally recruit him, though it was my area, my school. The 653rd best player in America is Damon Arnett, a corner from St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Florida. He was a kid that was committed to South Carolina, so he wasn't too under-recruited, but 653rd best player ends up being a starter at Ohio State for this is going to be his third year, and he should be a first-round pick. I know he had a setback last year. I could go into all the reasons why I think that happened, but Damon should be a first-round pick and should have an outstanding year at Ohio State. But Chris Ash was the one that just fell in love with him. We were looking for a corner, needed a corner. He just fell in love with him. I knew about him, but I didn't know he was Ohio State level, and I honestly... Luke and I both recruited the school, and he ended up overachieving thus far, and he's still under. That's just crazy. He overachieved from his high school ratings and his high school rankings and his high school projections. He's overachieved for that, but what I've seen from practice and development, he's underachieved in his college career. So that could be a huge, huge overachiever at the end of the day. The last honorable mention, the 192nd best player in America coming out of high school, which probably got bumped because of where he was ended up committing, was Sam Hubbard, 4-star, ended up going to Ohio State. And this is another example of a great recruiting staff. So this is a kid in Cincinnati. Kerry Combs is recruiting that area and just loves a kid. Big, freaky. Kid played safety, right? Huge, 6'6", whatever, huge kid, played safety. Was probably not a safety in college. And so no one really knew where to put him. Nowhere nationally knew where to put him. They were just like, this is a big freaky kid. I don't know what to do with him. And so they went in. Kerry Combs takes Urban there just as he takes him in a tour of Cincinnati. And they watch this kid. And this kid's playing Urban. Urban offered and signed this kid off of gym class dodgeball.
Really?
So the kid's playing dodgeball and just this athletic freak, huge, long arms, long legs, just long levered. Just running around playing, I guess, beating up all these normal-looking kids.
Did he look like Adam Sandler out there just throwing balls at these kids? Yeah, like,
right, imagine
towering over everybody.
Right, like Billy Madison. It was exactly. Wild. So we signed him, no clue as to what, and then a recruit, once he got on campus and we saw him move and saw him, I mean, he gained like 40 pounds after his senior in high school to his fall camp. And so there was all of a sudden the greatest recruiting battle ever was this Luke Fickell versus Tom Herman inner recruiting battle over who was going to get Sam Hubbard because we needed a tight end bad. And he would have been a ridiculous tight end. And obviously defense wins. So Urban shuffled him on defense, and the rest is history. Now he's a Cincinnati Bengal.
He got drafted too low.
No, he did, but
he dropped. I don't know why.
Well, I don't either. But he was he definitely was an overachiever, even though he ended up getting ranked, I guess, decently in the top 250. But he was a kid that I don't think anyone could have projected being a great defensive end. All right, now let's get to the top 10, and I got a couple on here that most fans probably won't know about. They were in my career at some smaller schools, and it's really should provide motivation to kids that don't get recruited by the a Power 5 school, right? And that's my number 10 player. The number 10 player that I coached at Temple was a wide receiver by the name of Rod Streeter, who still to this day is playing in the NFL, he might have just retired, but he had at least a 7-year career. So this kid was a Jersey kid that kind of played football in high school, not really, ended up going to a JUCO, and a coach at the time at Temple saw him when he was just out recruiting. He was a high jumper, right? He went there to be a track and field guy and a high jumper, and they took a flyer on him, took a chance. And the kid ended up having a decent career at Temple. He would have had probably a better career, but our offense was not a pass-friendly offense. But he ended up playing 7 years in the NFL. And phenomenal kid, phenomenal worker, and he is an example for a kid that gets under-recruited or doesn't have a lot going on out of high school to show you can make it. So that was my number 10 overachiever is Rod Streeter. The number 9 overachiever is Ahmad Black. I know Florida fans and SEC fans and people down in the South know him. He was an unranked player out of high school. He was really only taken because back then there was eight players went D1. I mean, big time. Back then it was called BCS, D1, that came out of Lakeland. You had the Pouncey twins, Chris Rainey. They had a kid go to, I think, LSU, a kid go to Tennessee. They had kids going everywhere. We signed 5 at Florida. And he was one that was kind of, we took just to get them all.
Yeah.
Ended up being an absolute, when you say a football, like 5'8", undersized, didn't have the measurables. That's why people didn't really recruit him. But he was a baller. And he was a three-time starter. I think he was was he an All-American?
Yeah, he was an All-American in 2010, so first team.
2010, first team All-American, and a great player. Not good, great player. So he's my number 9. Number 8, and this is, when I saw the rankings, I was shocked, and we'll get to the other one later. The number 8 most overachieving player or underrated player that I've seen would be Mike Pouncey. Mike Pouncey, first-round draft pick, multiple Pro Bowler, was ranked the 279th player nationally, a 3-star. And him and his brother had the it factor. I mean, they had it. And so he was an overachiever. He was definitely overachieving and underranked, I guess, go hand in hand, right? He was underranked and overachieved for sure and still playing. He'll play as long as his body lets him. That's how talented he is. All right, my number 7. Overachieving player in my career, Terry McLaurin. He was ranked the 248th best player in America, and he was a 4-star, probably a little bit of OSU bias. Now, the one thing about Terry is he was an athletic freak. He could run, jump, move, everything. He actually went to the opening and put up the numbers that should have won whatever the champion of the opening is, but they wanted to give it to some 5-star kid that was like the number 2 player in the country, so he didn't win it, but he should have. So shout out to the opening for being unbiased. But Terry was a kid that came to camp. Kerry Combs recruited the area, invited him to camp, didn't really think much of it. He came to camp. I fell in love with him. I mean, I'm working him out, and like, this kid has it. Not only does he have it, the way he moves, how explosive he is, but this character, like when I try to coach him or talk to him, I mean, I'm talking about he was burning holes through my eyeballs, just locked in, listening. Now, what he didn't have was good ball skills. And so what happens at camp is you go to the first session, you kind of pull the guys out you want, you work them out, you evaluate them, then everyone eats lunch. And the coaches kind of scurry off into the staff room and talk about the kids at camp. And discuss them, make a game plan, go back out, and then, you know, maybe you offer the kid after camp, maybe you pull him into the second session, whatever, but you make a game plan halfway through, right? So Terry, we go in, and Urban said he's in a bad mood. He's like, I didn't see a single player out there that could play at Ohio State. This is a waste of time, waste of my time. I said, Coach, I want to offer this kid from Indianapolis. He said, it was outside? I said, yeah, Coach, this kid, Terry McLaurin, I want to offer him. He said, offer him, offer him. Jesus Christ. Oh, what do I pay you for? All right. We're not offering anyone out there. You're talking about the kid that can't catch? He can't catch. What do you want him to play receiver here? He can't catch. Okay. You want him to just bat the ball down? Okay. Sounds good, Zach. Good call. So I'm like a scalded dog. I'm like, ah, shit, man. Ah, shit. I didn't have enough conviction on that one, obviously. So we go back out and calls him in, and he basically just calls the kid out. He goes, listen, Zach loves you, wants to offer you. I don't want to. So I'm going to invite you back to Friday Night Lights. You can't catch the ball, Terry. If you want to play at Ohio State, you got to catch the ball. And I remember Terry, grown-ass man, looked at him and said, gotcha. He went and caught 200 footballs every day from that camp until Friday Night Lights. He told me stories of his mom had him out back throwing him footballs, like just catching balls, catching balls, catching balls. He came back to Friday Night Lights, all Urban was looking for was improvement. So he saw an improvement in ball skills at Friday Night Lights, and that told him one thing and told me one thing. That kid's going to work at it because ball skills can be taught and developed. People think it's a natural thing. You can develop that. And Terry's done it. You look at him this past year, he had great ball skills.
Well, he just had a video come out of a ridiculous catch for a touchdown that Dwayne threw him at the Redskins.
Yeah. He's got it now, but that's because of hard work. So he overachieved, and he overachieved because he worked to overachieve, right? So that's my number seven. Number six, I put Malik Hooker. The 360th best player in America was a three-star recruited by Luke Fickell again. He was a hooper. And Coach Mick, his freshman year, because he didn't like football that much. He didn't know that he liked football that much when he first got to Ohio State. And Coach Mick used to run around the weight room going, he's a hooper. He's a hooper. And just to make fun of him for not, you know, being all in on football and working hard. So he struggled as a freshman a lot. And going back to that vaginitis project, all of them do usually, especially, and there's right now, I bet you he would say he loves Urban Meyer, loves the program. It made him who he is today. Right. But as a freshman, he would not have said that. He actually was going to quit his freshman year ready. He was packing it in, going home, and his roommate, Noah Brown, talked him into toughing it out and staying. And he obviously is very grateful for staying. But he is my number six overachiever. Number five is Darren Lee. Darren Lee was a three-star quarterback, 636th best player in America. Darren Lee came to camp, another Luke Fickell recruit. And all he did was work and show explosion. But he worked out at receiver the first two times he came to camp. And the second time I came in and I told Luke, I said, listen, this kid is an Ohio State player. I don't know what he is, but we need to recruit him, offer him, get him. But he ain't a receiver. I don't like we keep putting him at receiver. He's not a receiver. And I'm like, but I'm telling you right now, this kid belongs here. He needs to be at Ohio State. And Darren will tell you that story. And Luke was like, all right, let's work him out. So that was at one of those lunchtime campfire meetings that the staff had. So we come in. We go back out, and Darren works out with the defensive staff. Sure enough, I think he was committed by the time he left the camp because they saw what I saw. They agreed, and they just hadn't laid eyes on him yet because he'd worked out at receiver before. So they worked him out, loved him. He ended up coming in one of the fastest. Him and Ryan Shazier, the two fastest linebackers I've ever seen, couldn't absolutely fly. And you talk about explosive and had a mentality, an attitude about him. So he's number five. Number four. This is another small-time college player, was the 1,531st ranked player in America. That's over 1,500 players better than him.
For that year.
From Charleston, West Virginia, was a kid named Aaron Dobson, who played for me at Marshall and ended up being a first-round draft pick. And he wouldn't even played at Marshall had he not come to camp prior to me being there. He came to camp, ran really well, jumped really well, another basketball player, 6'3", great kid, great family, great everything. And he came in and just worked. And he ended up getting first-round draft pick to the Patriots. It really had a kind of injury-laden career. I believe he's still playing or trying to get back in it. But he was a phenomenal college football player that was very underranked and overachieved. My number three overachieving player was Pat Elflein. Another Luke Fickell recruit. Pat Elflein was a three-star. He was the lowest-rated recruit in the 2012 class at Ohio State, the 998th best player in America. That's almost 1,000 kids better than Pat Elflein. But Luke Fickell loved him. He was a tough-ass Ohio kid from outside of Columbus, a wrestler, a big kid, athletic, could bend, ends up a Remington Award winner, is a grown-ass man, and is a bona fide badass. Like one of those kids that as a coach, player, GM, a nose guard, it doesn't matter. You're going to respect Pat Elflein. He was very low rated, and he overachieved. I mean, I don't know that anyone could have projected that. He was one of two Remington Award winners at Ohio State under Urban Meyer's tenure. The number two overachiever was one near and dear to my heart, the Michael Thomas. Go ahead.
Can't guard Mike.
Can't guard Mike. And you can't. Money talks, right? He was a three-star recruit. Ended up, Ohio State signed him. Ended up, not because of academics, because he's a really smart kid. Ended up putting him in prep school because they didn't have the room in the class or whatever. So they signed him and put him in prep school. He ended up coming in and should have been an All-American, should have been a first-round pick. And I don't care. You know what? He was a first-round pick. I know he wasn't, but he was. He was better than every other receiver. He's produced more. Should have been. Sorry, NFL screwed it up. I'm calling him a first-rounder. Get over it.
Well, I remember we watched the draft together when Mike went, and when the Browns took Corey Coleman over Michael Thomas, hung your head and were like, what the hell? Like, yep. What are we doing?
Yeah, that was about that was where they almost lost me as a fan. I've been a Browns fan my whole life, and there was those two drafts back-to-back. When they didn't draft Mike and drafted a receiver out of Baylor, I was like, oh, my God, I got to find another team. Luckily, he went to the Saints, so I could pick up the Saints because that was my guy. But he was a three-star. The only reason people really knew about him is he was Keyshawn's nephew, and I've watched his film. It was good film. I don't know what USC was doing. I don't know why they would. I don't know why people didn't take a chance on this kid. But I wasn't at Ohio State when he was recruited. But he is definitely the number two overachiever in my career. And there was quite a debate over two and one.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's hard to say the best receiver in the NFL right now that was a three-star that had to go to prep school is not the biggest overachiever. But I will tell you, his next one is the best offensive lineman I've ever seen, and he has the mentality to back it up. The 227th best player nationally was Marquise Pouncey. Remington Award winner, first-round draft pick, multiple-time Pro Bowler.
Super Bowls. I mean, he has done it all.
You name it. Marquise Pouncey is it. And he is the epitome of what you want in an offensive lineman. He had that dog mentality, leadership, talk shit, tatted up, badass, athletic as hell. And he is that energy giver on a team.
Yeah, he just seems like the kind of guy that you don't want to go against. Like, don't want to be on the other side.
You don't. And he was, again, going back to it, I was at Florida when we recruited him. I don't remember him being ranked as low as him and his brother were. It's like 227th nationally. I remember we were, like, had to have him. So, but, I mean, the recruiting services have come a long way since then. I think that was 07 class, maybe? Yeah, it was, because 08, he started as a freshman. That was, I'll tell you, they've come a long way. With the advent of 247 sports, and it's gotten more serious. People have gotten more experience. They've hired more experienced evaluators. They've gotten much better at it because back then it was kind of a makeshift. You'd be like, that kid's number one and this kid's 227. Come on. But anyways, the number one overachieving player, in my opinion, in my career, is Marquise Pouncey.
So I noticed there's a lot of the players from Florida and Ohio State, obviously, because that's where you spent most of your career. But there's also a lot of players that were part of two different teams that we keep teasing we want to talk about.
Yeah, let's get into that right now. The ultimate analysis from someone who was inside the staff room on both teams. Let's compare the 2008 Florida Gators versus the 2014 Ohio State Buckeyes. All right, starting with the 2008 Florida Gators, 13-1 SEC and national champions that defeated the Heisman winner Sam Bradford and the Boomer Sooners of Oklahoma. The Florida Gators in 2008 had a point differential 611-181, 430-point differential. Wow. They played six teams, four of them in the top 10. In those games, the point differential was 170, outscoring those opponents 256-86. On offense, they had the number one offense in the SEC, 15th nationally, against vaunted SEC defenses, especially back then. Their defense was ninth in the country overall, third in the SEC against not-so-vaunted offenses. versus the 2014 Ohio State Buckeyes, 14-1, the first college football playoff champions. Point differential of 342, outscoring teams 672 points to 330. They also played four top 10 teams that year, with a 100-point differential, outscoring them 192 to 92. They also played an extra championship style of game with the advent and introduction of the college football playoff. They had the number one offense in the Big Ten, the number two offense in the United States of America. Their defense was 19th in the country, 5th in the Big Ten. So let's break down these teams position by position, right? At quarterback.
This one's not even close.
At quarterback for your Florida Gators, Heisman Trophy winner, Tim Tebow versus JT Barrett / Cardale Jones, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're saying this is a national championship matchup, at this point, it's fair to say Cardale is the quarterback, right?
Yeah, JT's hurt.
Yeah, I mean, you can't just say everyone on the team is playing, right? This is, if they played at the end of the year, they both played that season, played at the end of the year, Cardale's the quarterback, right? Who you give an edge to?
I definitely would go Florida, right?
Well, Tebow won a Heisman. You can't give it to someone.
But Tebow also was an incredible college football player.
Yep.
So I'm giving the edge to Florida, and not because of who was a better quarterback, but I guess it goes down to what do you classify that word or position as? Like the best leader, captain, overall player, Tim Tebow, by far, might take him over anyone that's played the game at quarterback, right? Because he was that dynamic of a leader and player. So the edge has got to go to Florida at quarterback, right? So that's already a strike against the Buckeyes. Because Florida, the better quarterback usually wins the game, right? So Tim Tebow takes the edge at quarterback. Now let's go to the running back position, right? This is where it is a landslide, not even close. I bet you outside of Florida fans, no one can even name a running back on the Florida team.
I sure can't.
At running back for the Ohio State Buckeyes, you have one of the top running backs in the NFL in Ezekiel Elliott and one of the top running backs in college football at the time. You also had his backup, Curtis Samuel, second-round pick, now with the Carolina Panthers. At Florida, their starting running back was Keystone Moore, who no one probably knows outside of Florida fans. So I don't think it's even close. I mean, Zeke was the most dynamic and impactful running back in the country that year and in recent memory, one of the top, right? And so at running back, it's not even close. Ohio State takes that one. Anyone disagree?
No, not at all.
No, you can't disagree with that, right? No. Now is where it gets interesting, right?
The skill
around your vaunted captain. At Florida, you had Percy Harvin in the slot, Aaron Hernandez at tight end, Riley Cooper and Lewis Murphy on the outside, with several other role players behind them. Probably one of the most talented group of skill players I've seen. Percy was, in my opinion, the best playmaker to play the game. You could argue me Reggie Bush. Other than that, I don't see one. Percy was that influential. And here's the thing about Percy. Percy, he was kind of inconsistent. You never knew who you were going to get. So, like I told you before, one time he just didn't show up for the game, South Carolina.
He might have had a headache.
But the issue was when the lights were the brightest and the stage was the biggest, Percy Harvin showed up. So on this stage, he would have been the best version of Percy you would have seen.
Yeah, that was proven in the Super Bowl, I think.
Super Bowl, the national championship game against Oklahoma. Yeah. He took it over. And then Aaron Hernandez, I mean, let's not talk about him off the field, but he was one of the most dynamic, big skill players to play the game, right? So that's at Florida. Then you switch over to Ohio State. Michael Thomas, who was the best receiver in college football that year. I don't care what anyone says. And it's being proven in the NFL. He was unguardable. Can't guard Mike, right? Michael Thomas. And then on the other side was Devin Smith, the best deep threat in college football. He averaged over 28 yards per catch.
That's amazing.
I want to say he led the country by 5 yards per catch. His average. He was uncoverable. So Kirby Smart told Tom Herman after the game, like Tom Herman went to Houston, actually went to Alabama to talk football. And they told Tom Herman that there was a check they had. When Devin Smith was in the game, they checked their entire defense to play two-man. What that means is the corner can slide underneath and get behind Devin, right? So that everything underneath is taken away. He has no fear of getting beat deep because there's a safety over the top. Devin hit him on two deep balls, one for a touchdown, because he outran the safety. The safety's lining up at 12 yards and going backwards. And Devin had such, you know what he had? He had such elite speed from like 20 to 60. Like he was a 4.4 kid, low 4.4 kid in the 40. But his speed from 20 yards to 60 yards was like none other. And then you had some unbelievable other talented players. Jeff Heirman was the tight end, still playing in the NFL. A much more impactful player in the run game. Aaron Hernandez was a skill player that was just really a big receiver. Jeff Heirman could eliminate a defensive end in the run game. And that's what people don't know or talk about. Florida didn't have that. The Florida run game was influencing and Tebow running to add to equate numbers.
Did Aaron even line up on the line?
He did occasionally, but he was not good. He was not good at it. He certainly couldn't block a big-time defensive. He certainly wasn't blocking Joey Bosa.
Yeah.
Well, no.
But Jeff Heirman was so cockstrong. Just he got his hands on you, and he could just completely stone a defensive end and one-on-one block him. And that's very uncommon. That's why he's still playing and will play in the NFL, because he was a proficient receiving tight end, but he could block. And then you had guys like Jalen Marshall, who was a great punt returner, great in the slot, big, I mean, almost like a big running back playing receiver. And Evan Spencer, the MVP of the team, Urban dubbed him, because he was that good at executing. When you needed a job done, he got the job done. As far as blocking, as far as cracking safeties, as far as running good routes, as far as ball skills, catching the ball, he was a very, very valuable member. So who do you give the edge to?
I think that's really close.
That's tough. I don't know. Even.
I would probably give a slight edge to Florida.
All right. It'd be tough to not give Florida the edge with Percy Harvin. But as far as a football game, all facets included, including the run game, including blocking defensive ends, including blocking on the perimeter, I'm going to switch it up. I picked Florida before we started the show, but I'm switching it up right now. I'm taking Ohio State right now. They'll block better than Florida on the perimeter. You got Zeke on the perimeter with Jalen in the slot and Evan Spencer outside. It's over. I'm taking Jeff Heirman blocking that defensive end to get Zeke started. I'm taking Florida's skill players in the throw game, but Ohio State's skill players in the overall football game. Now I think the biggest differential of the two teams, let's get to the offensive line. For the Gators, you had two of the best I've ever seen, the Pouncey Twins, right next to each other. They're going to create a problem for the interior of your defense. They had a Remington Award winner at center and a first-round draft pick at guard. The other three linemen were serviceable. Phil Troutwine was a very good player. Not a great player, good player. Jason Watkins was a below good player. I'll say average. Jim Tart was a good player. He exceeded his skill set and was very accountable. So they had a good offensive line. Not elite. Elite. Not elite. But a good offensive line. Now let's get to the Ohio State Buckeyes offensive line. And back to why people say, was Ed Warner a good coach? Yeah, he was a good coach. Not a great coach. It's like if I coached Percy Harvin, Mike Thomas, and Devin Smith all in the same room, I'd be really good. Now, part of that's development, but another part of it is you have some talent, man, that you didn't recruit. So they had three first-rounders, two Remington Award winners in Taylor Decker at left tackle, Pat Elflein, Billy Price at the two guards. And the center was the most underrated player in college football. Was never going to be an NFL player, but Jacoby Boren, 6 foot, 285, undersized. But he was nasty. You know what he did? He got the job done. The right tackle was a little bit of a liability, a little stiff, but he was a very good pass blocker, was Darryl Baldwin. So got to give the edge to Ohio State, right?
Yeah, I think Ohio State's line was much better.
So you had two Remington Award winners. They had three first rounders, and Florida had two. And I would say that Florida's offensive line was much better coached, and it's a testament, right? Who's the coach of each unit? Florida's offensive line was not as talented.
But I feel like Florida would have struggled with the edge rushers.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to that in a minute. They definitely would have had their hands full.
Yeah.
And that was their issue, right? I think whereas Ohio State had Taylor Decker, a first-round tackle. Darryl Baldwin was a great pass blocker. They had the ability to throw the football with Cardale Jones because you had two pillars at tackle that could pass pro.
Well, I think also, if you look at it, Ohio State had much more talented players and a serviceable coach. Florida had less talent and a really good O-line coach.
Exactly. And so who would have played well? Florida's O-line would have played well, but they would have struggled on the edge, like you said. So we'll get to the matchup in a minute. So overall, better offense. Got to go with Ohio State, right?
I picked Florida personally, but I do think Ohio State would cause a lot of problems with their offensive line.
Yeah. I think the offensive line becomes a slight edge, right?
I'm taking Florida.
Well, that's
Tebow and Percy.
Yeah, Tebow and Percy. I'm with you, but as we get to it here, the Ohio State defense had the ability to take out a great player. They did. And now I don't know if anyone could take out Percy, but you could take out a great player. And eventually, how many times are you going to run Tebow? I mean, 30 probably, right?
35,
but at the
40,
end of the day,
whatever it takes.
At the end of the day, that was their only run game, was the quarterback run game. They had no running back run game. They were very, very one-dimensional in the run game. And it was definitely a problem, definitely hard to deal with. But I'm taking Ohio State. Offensive line overcomes a slight edge in the skill quarterback realm, right? The backfield and skill. And at the end of the day, one of the things you have to look at is the star power and how that translated to the NFL. And we'll get into that in a minute. But you got to look at that because especially when you're comparing two teams 11 years apart or whatever, 6 years apart, right? Mm-hmm. You have to. All right, let's get to the defense. The defensive line for the Florida Gators. They had on one edge, Carlos Dunlap, if he was not suspended, is rushing the passer. An elite pass rusher, right? 6'8", long, explosive. Was a second rounder because he was lazy. He was lazy and he would take plays off, and that's a liability. But he is still playing in the NFL. Also on the other edge had Jermaine Cunningham. He was more of a rush defensive end, not as big, but he was a very explosive, quick pass rusher. Was also a second rounder. In the interiors where they struggled, the Florida defensive line. Now, they did have one kid, Justin Tradau, who was undrafted, had a decent college career, but he was an extremely hard worker, high-effort guy, ended up playing in the NFL for 7 years. Their other D-tackle was a complete liability. Complete liability. Then you go to Ohio State's defensive line. The best D-lineman I've ever seen on one end, Joey Bosa, would have been a problem for those tackles Florida.
He was a problem for every tackle.
He's right? He's a problem for the top tackle in the NFL. So he would have been a problem for the good tackles at Florida. Then you had on the interior Adolphus Washington and Michael Bennett, both very, very solid defensive tackles. Michael Bennett was a stout nose guard. Adolphus Washington was a very athletic three technique. He was a third rounder, still playing right now. They would have been the Pounceys would have handled them. The Pounceys would have handled them. If Ohio State would have found a way to get Adolphus Washington on Jim Tart, that would have been a pass rush nightmare for Florida. But that would have been a decent matchup. Interior would be a Michael Bennett versus the Pouncey Twins. Not decent. The Pouncey Twins would have won that matchup. Who are you giving the edge to?
I think just like we said with Tebow and Harvin, I think Bosa is a complete game changer.
Bosa.
You got to go with Ohio State.
I mean, it's definitely Ohio State, but I think it's even supersedes just Bosa. Bosa is a game changer. He would have probably won that matchup or comparison by himself. But the lack of defensive tackle performance by Florida compared to the defensive tackles at Ohio State, the defensive tackle position was a liability at Florida. It was a strength at Ohio State. So you got to go with Ohio State's defensive line. Linebackers. Get to the linebackers. In the middle for the Florida Gators, one of the most intimidating players I've ever been around, Brandon Spikes, couldn't run.
No, he ran bad.
5'1", 40, but he was a force to be reckoned with when it came to football's IQ, you know, savviness, awareness, and then just nastiness to the ball.
Instincts.
And he's one of the few linebackers I've seen in inside drill take on a pulling guard and knock him off his feet. You're talking about a 310-pound guard, right? This kid was that just nasty and explosive at contact. So he would have been a problem. But there's ways to expose him because he couldn't run. The other two linebackers, I bet you no one outside of Florida fans knows. A.J. Jones and Dustin Doe. They were serviceable linebackers. What Charlie Strong asked them to do on defense was very simplistic. Ryan Stamper was also one of the linebackers. I think he ended up being the starter. And Ryan Stamper was a very, very intelligent player. But he wasn't athletically inclined. He ended up starting over, I think, A.J. Jones. So I'm taking let's get to Ohio State now. Ohio State in the middle, similar to Spikes. He was the heart and soul of the defense, the heartbeat, if you may. Curtis Grant in the middle. Also, not the best athlete, but he made up for it when it came to his presence on the field. He had that Ray Lewis ability to inspire, to speak to a team. Then on the outside, to the field, you know, your walkout linebacker. One of the better linebackers I've seen was Darren Lee. Darren Lee had the ability to play linebacker against the run game. A receiver could never block him. He was too quick, too explosive, and too physical. But he also could run with receivers in the pass game. That's how fast he was. I think he went sub 4.4 in the combine, didn't he?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
low 4.4. First rounder, dynamic player. When we played Oregon, they tried to throw bubble screens. Not one was happening because they didn't have a guy who would even touch him, let alone if they did touch him, they could stop him. But Darren Lee would have been an impact player. And then Josh Perry, the Will linebacker. He's a prototype Will linebacker. I mean, 6'4", long, could run straight line like the wind. So who are you giving the edge to?
Ohio State.
Yeah, I think Ohio State has better linebackers in that scenario. I think Spikes is a little bit better than Grant was, maybe.
Yeah, I'm taking Ohio State, and I don't think it's close. I think you could argue Curtis Grant and Spikes are negligible. They kind of wash each other out. They're both similar players. They're both the heartbeat of the defense. Very, very good middle linebackers. Exactly what you want. But they didn't run great, which you don't always need from a Mike linebacker. But then you got to take Josh Perry over Dustin Doe or Ryan Stamper, and you got to take Darren Lee over A.J. Jones or Dustin Doe. You have to. It's a landslide. So I think Ohio State's linebackers win running away. Now let's get to the secondary. It's an interesting comparison. At Florida, you had the best corner playing in this game, Joe Hayden. He had the ability to take players out like A.J. Green's and Julio Jones's. Now, you can't take Julio Jones out, but he was able to cover him.
Yeah, he was one of the best man cover corners that I've seen.
Yeah, for sure. And he's still playing. Still playing.
He could take away A.J. Green just to this day.
Yeah,
he has.
He did it in college.
Entire career.
did it in the NFL. Going to continue to do it. Joe Hayden is a difference maker in the back end. And then you look at the safety positions. Florida had Major Wright, the eraser. Granted, as you mentioned before the show, probably nowadays would have been ejected mid-first quarter.
Yeah, I mean, one hit.
That kid can hit, though.
Yeah, but
he wasn't big.
He would have adjusted his game. He would have adjusted it. So Major Wright as the eraser in the back end. And then Ahmad Black, the overachieving Ahmad Black, football player, All-American. Playing strong safety. The cornerback position is a huge concern in this matchup because there was a slew of people that played it. And whoever it was would have had a major problem with either Devin Smith or Mike Thomas. Whoever you put them on. Let's say that, and Joe Hayden couldn't take Mike out of the game. It would have been a battle. But let's say you put him on Mike. Who's covering Devin Smith? I'll answer the question for you. Nobody. And let's say you say, all right, Devin's too big of a deep threat. Let's put Joe Hayden on Devin. Mike Thomas is going for 200 yards.
Oh, yeah. You'd have to put Joe on Mike.
Yeah, Joe will go on Mike.
So, getting back to the secondary, the Ohio State Buckeyes. On one side, you had Duran Grant, really good college football player, had a short stint in the NFL, was kind of the beginning of cornerback U for the next 3 years of all the first rounders. And you had a number of first round players eventually that were young. Eli Apple on one side, who played good that year. I wouldn't say great, but he developed into a first rounder. You had a young Gerrion Conley, who ended up being a great corner, but at that time he was young. Didn't play a ton, played some nickel, played a little bit. The safety position is the biggest concern for the Buckeyes. You had Von Bell, who was a great player, still playing for the Saints. I think he was a second round draft pick, was excellent, played really well against Alabama, played really well against a lot of teams. He would have been able to impact the game. And then you had Tyvis Powell, who was not a bad player. He was just a good player. But he was also a risk taker. He was a long-range safety that I think could have been a liability against the skill at Florida. So where do you give the edge?
I'm going with Florida because of Joe Hayden, and then their safeties, I think, are a little better too.
Mm-hmm. I think Ohio State.
Really?
Yep. Eli Apple, Von Bell. Those two right there.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. Eli Apple just wasn't playing like Eli Apple
he
did the next year.
Yeah.
So I'm giving the edge to Florida. Ohio State had young talent at corner, and Eli Apple played above his ability that year. He ended up playing better the next year. He played more. I still don't know if he was a first rounder from what I saw. He was also going against Mike Thomas every day, so that's tough to knock him for going against that great of a player. But I think Joe Hayden's a difference maker, like you said. Ohio State didn't have Joe Hayden. Florida did. Safeties as a whole weren't even close. Ahmad Black was a great football player, a great drop-down strong safety and a one-high man defense, and Major Wright was the eraser. Similar secondaries, but the safety combo and Joe Hayden give the edge to the Gators.
Ohio State, in hindsight, had a more talented secondary as far as depth, but they were young and not the Jim Conley and Eli Apple we all know. So the better defense, who you got?
I think Ohio State.
I think it's really close. I think Ohio State might have better, a more talented defense, but it's hard to ignore that Florida only gave up 13 points a game.
True.
So that defense obviously performed.
Yeah, I think Ohio State had a better front seven overall, and they had a couple impact players, but I'm giving the better defense to Florida.
I guess Ohio State's secondary is pretty young, so
that's the issue, right?
They're not like quite who they were.
Like to yet. Say Ohio State's front seven's better, that I agree. I think that's true. But Florida's front seven was not far off. It was no slouch. And having the second best defense in the SEC back in 2008, when the SEC was the best defensive conference in football, versus Ohio State being the fifth best defense in the Big Ten, you got to give the edge to Florida.
I agree.
So here's what I see as an analysis of the game. When Florida's on offense, they would have to find a way to neutralize Joey Bosa, get Percy Harvin matched up on Tyvis Powell or one of the young corners. And ultimately, the Ohio State defense wouldn't be able to cover the depth of skill that Florida had. One of the young corners on Lewis Murphy would have been problematic. Aaron Hernandez would have been the underperformer in this game, though. A combo of Von Bell and Darren Lee would have helped eliminate him from the game. Now, you're not going to eliminate him entirely, but he would not have been the explosive and productive Aaron Hernandez we watched. But it would have taken both of them. It would have taken two great players to take him out of the game. The run game would have been extremely difficult. The element of equalizing numbers by having the Florida version of Zeke Elliott in Tim Tebow would have provided a ground game, and the implementation of Percy Harvin in the backfield with the threat of Tebow run would have provided a spark. Now, when Ohio State was on offense, despite the stout defense Florida had, they would have struggled with the Ohio State offensive line and run game. Ezekiel Elliott would have been able to run, and that is a problem. Assuming Cardale's the quarterback, with this being the end of the year, Joe Hayden and Major Wright were good enough to stop either Devin Smith on the deep ball or Mike Thomas, possibly one-on-one. The problem is you couldn't stop both, and they didn't have the personnel to stop both. The interior defenders would have had more than their hands full with Jalen Marshall. Florida didn't have a linebacker that could run with them. They didn't have a nickel or safety that could cover them. This would have been an offensive firepower that Florida hadn't seen. The SEC was the best conference in college football in 2008, the best defensive conference I've ever seen back in 2008, but they did not have offenses like Ohio State had in 2014. The one caveat was how the Ohio State defense was playing towards the end of the year. They held the three players that went to New York City for the Heisman Trophy ceremony to next to nothing. Melvin Gordon, Amari Cooper, Marcus Mariota, down the stretch, back to back to back. Didn't really do anything. I think Florida would have had a better offensive game plan. Dan Mullen was far more meticulous and thorough as a coordinator, but Tom Herman was riskier, kind of a loose cannon. Tom would have had trick plays, trick formations, unique looks, and rode his superstars to an offensive explosion. Ohio State played two defenses for 90% of regular down and distance snaps. And that would have allowed them to play fast, but also get game planned. Florida relied on cat coverage, what I call cat coverage. A lot of times in the South, they play cat coverage. You know what that means? I got that cat, you got that cat, you got that cat. Straight man to man. They had the personnel to do it against a lot of teams. Because in the SEC, who had two or three great receivers? Nobody. No. You had A.J. Green at Georgia. You had Julio Jones at Alabama. You had a one-trick pony. So they could put Joe on him, tell Major to favor that side, take him out of the game. Not going to happen against the Buckeyes in 2014. That would have given guys like Michael Thomas and Devin Smith the stage to expose a mismatch. I don't know who would have gotten it, but either one would have exposed it. Ohio State managed to minimize Amari Cooper, who was the best wide receiver in college football in 2014. He only had two plays, and one was a double move kind of trick play where they caught Tyvis Powell biting because he was an aggressive player. He was a playmaker that averaged around 9 a game or more. Alabama's offense was vocally announced to the players by Lane Kiffin, the coordinator at the time, that my goal is to win one receiver, the Biletnikoff. That's my offense. And he did it. Mm-hmm. But he was eliminated from the game. They could have eliminated that single great player out of the game, but the struggle would have been managing the next four that Florida had. In a make-believe land of comparing decade different teams, NFL production should be brought into play. Agree or disagree?
I think so, slightly at least. I think it's hard to measure college football versus how they do in the NFL. But I definitely, like, Mike Thomas is obviously one of the best players in the NFL right now, and that should play a role in how you evaluate him.
But what about Tim Tebow?
That's what I hesitate with, because Tim Tebow, probably
the,
you can't
the best
really,
college football player.
Yeah, you can't really use NFL evaluation on him.
See, here's how I see it. I understand injuries play a part of it, and transitioning to the NFL game should not dictate the impact of a Tim Tebow type of player, mm-hmm. but it can bridge a gap that is created by time. How good was Percy Harvin? How good was Michael Thomas? Well, there's different eras, different offenses, defenses, different personnel. But I think you can say, all right, when they made it to the league, best of the best, how'd they do? Now, Tim Tebow, everyone knew, was an iconic college player and might struggle in the NFL. Everyone knew it.
Yeah.
But he was one of the best and most impactful college players in the history of the game. Ohio State gets the clear NFL carryover points with Zeke, Michael Thomas, Bosa, the O-linemen, the slew of great players that are now great players at the next level. But all in all, with the way Ohio State's defense came together and was executing at the end of the year, I think this would go down as one of the top two or three matchups, if not the best ever, in the history of the game. But I'm taking Ohio State 35-31.
See, I disagree. I think Florida, I think Tim Tebow wills that team to beat Ohio
State.
I
was going to say the exact same
thing. I have a tough time picking against Tim Tebow.
They'll have a jump pass at the end.
Something.
Win the game. That's what I think.
That's why it's make-believe, right? I'm taking Ohio State because I think that Ohio State was a very different team as far as the chemistry, the development, and how they were playing at the end of the year was better than Florida played ever. Now, if you took the whole season as a whole, which really does, it's not a huge indication. It's how they're playing when it matters, right?
Yeah.
But if you take the whole season, I'm with you, Florida. I'm taking Florida. But if you take how they're playing at the end of the year, I think Ohio State wins 35-31. And if you really want to get more specific, they had a much more experienced and older coach.
Yeah, I think that's one thing we didn't talk much about was the coaching staffs. They were similar, but very different.
Similar and different. I don't think you could pick one or the other. I think you're talking about some of the most elite assistant coaches in the country and also guys that are now very, very successful head coaches. So I think that it's pretty much a wash. Both very, very elite coaching staffs.
Well, so, 2008 or 2014, Urban.
I'm telling you, 14 for 14? Sure.
Yeah, I probably take 14, not, Urban.
Not even close. I mean, he was much more experienced and he was great both years, but obviously you got to get better with age and time, right? He's wiser. He's wiser.
He's wiser.
So yes. We had the edge. We had the 14 Urban. Sorry, 08 Florida. So that's where I'm at. I think next we got to go the 01 Hurricanes.
Yeah, I think another great team.
I think we got to go 0-1 Hurricanes. That might be the best team in the history of the game when we really break them down. So we'll do that in a future episode. But I really think this would be fun to kind of look at and analyze and talk about.
That was when they played at the OB.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, I appreciate it. I just wanted to get a great conversation. Great. It's fun to do. Just want to preview some episodes coming up. The one thing we haven't talked about, a lot of people want to know, will it be addressed? And I'm excited to. I want to talk about Burt McMurphy. Burt McDirt. I want to do a deep dive into the most unethical reporting I have ever seen or witnessed. A man fighting to return to relevancy after being fired that would destroy a school of preschool kids to get his douche mustache back on any TV set in America. I also want to dive into some recruiting. I got a couple people I want to bring on as special guests that really know what's going on the inside of these recruiting battles, these kids, because obviously I've been out of it for a year. I want to analyze the kind of Ohio State for sure, the roster, what they need, where they're going to go, just knowing how the numbers work and how it works in the staff room. I also want to look at nationally where teams are at, kind of who has momentum, where they're going, really dive into recruiting a little deeper. I also want to talk about the top 10 players that did not live up to the hype, the counterpart to today's top 10. And then I also want to bring up the live show. We have two venues we're discussing with currently, but nothing's in concrete. And I would really love your feedback. Where would you go? Where would you want to go? Where have you been that you think this would be awesome? I also want to break down the quarterback position, the most important position on the field, specifically the Big Ten. Really want to dive in deep on the quarterbacks coming to the Big Ten this fall and also provide national analysis, how it relates, how it compares, talk about some big-time quarterbacks in the country. and the state of the quarterback position nowadays with the Star Trek transfer portal and how these college football teams are doing it. So that's coming soon. Also want to mention the Menace to Society merchandise that's coming. The store is going to launch in probably 2 weeks right now, we're scheduled to do. We have some great Menace to Society apparel. The first shipment of Menace Society shirts are coming in within the next 2 weeks. We're going to ship them out to all of our all-in and VIP members on Patreon ASAP, and they'll also be available for sale. We'll also do some pre-sale on those shirts and also some Zone 6 apparel. And also the Trash Talk line we've been talking about is hilarious shirts from show topics, things we just think are funny and think you might enjoy. Just a reminder, I'm telling you, subscribe to Patreon. You won't be disappointed. The cheapest one's $5 a month. It goes up to $20 a month, depending on what you want, what all access you want, what all content you want. And it's really a fluid working platform right now. I mean, we're going to offer so much stuff that we just want to make sure it's a good experience. And then again, I'll bring up sponsorship and advertising platform is open. Contact us at sponsorship@menacesocietypodcast.com. That wraps it up for us. We'll be back on Wednesday for Patreon subscribers and Thursday for the rest of the listeners. And appreciate you listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it was entertaining. And if you didn't like it, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
Menace to society.